Chapter 8. Joe, Skippy sighed just before his avatar appeared above the can of shaving cream on the sink in my cabin. The verbal warning before his hologram dropped into my life was a relatively new thing we had worked out. It's something I had requested for years, but in the past he had generally ignored my protests. Why was he suddenly being cooperative? There wasn't any mystery about that. Despite just claiming that he is the man for his heroic inaction during the AI war, he knew the truth. He was embarrassed about getting played by Opie, and he knew everyone aboard the ship was pissed at him. Worse, the crew were disappointed with him. He had been crowing about his greatest triumph right before his ultimate screw-up, so he was actually making an effort to be nice and generally not talking to people unless they called him, behavior that he likely thought would make people like him again. I had a newsflash for him. His radical change in behavior only reminded people of why he wasn't being as much of an arrogant jerk as usual. "Yeah, Skippy," I said with one side of my mouth as I closed the other side to shave under my nose. It was great that he gave me a heads up. Too many times he startled me while I was shaving and I cut myself. Since Task Force Black was a special operations group, technically I could grow a beard if I wanted. That would really make me look like a pirate. Unfortunately, Sims had told me no, and Margaret had said no. So there I was each morning, or morning-ish if I went to the gym early, scraping a razor across the stubble on my face. Why can't a bad boy like me just be a bad boy, you know? I guess asking my girlfriend for permission to grow a beard disqualifies me from being in the bad boys club. I hate to say this. Really, I do hate to say this. We have another major problem. No, we don't. I kept scraping the razor over my face. We don't? Well, I haven't even told you what the... You don't need to tell me. I finished, ran the razor under the faucet, and splashed water on my face to rinse. Sometimes I shaved while in the shower, but that used more water, and the engineers were begging the crew to cut back on water usage. Why? Well, they screwed up the water recycling system while trying to understand how it works, and they had only been able to partially fix it. Why didn't I order Skippy to fix it? He was pissed at the engineers, and I kinda couldn't blame him. He had created a whole set of YouTube videos about the recycling system, including how to perform preventative and periodic maintenance. Specifically, the videos explained in great detail how filthy monkeys could do the job, since those jobs were normally handled by bots, without the crew knowing anything was going on. The reason Skippy was upset, and I sympathized with him, is the engineering team skipped over most of the videos. Is that because Skippy sang when he narrated most of the instructions? He did do that. However, that was not the reason. The engineers got sick of him talking down to them. I understand it's not much fun to watch a technical instruction video in the form of a Sesame Street episode. Although the video where Oscar the Grouch gave an overview of the ship's wastewater system was hilarious. And yes, it would have been better if Skippy didn't have Big Bird and Elmo act as presenters. Also, I'm sure using those characters is a major copyright violation that Skippy's lawyers will have to handle when we get back to Earth. The point is, the engineers should have just embraced the suck and watched the damn videos. The rest of the crew has to deal with Skippy's bullshit. The engineering team is not special. They sure knew that from the dirty looks they got from the crew who could no longer enjoy the Hollywood showers they had gotten used to aboard our battlecruiser. The result was that on my order, the engineering team was restricted to 30 seconds of hot water per day per person until they fixed their screw-up. There's a rumor that Chief Engineer Chandra had voluntold his junior team members to sit through Skippy's epic opera suckfest in hopes of getting the beer can's help, but I'm officially staying out of that mess. Why am I going on blah, blah, blah about water? I really, really did not want to hear about whatever problem Skippy was eager to dump in my lap. I don't need to tell you, he blinked at me, because you already know about it. No, I don't need to hear because there can't be another major problem. It's just math. Math, which you are going to explain to me, he said very slowly, his eyes bulging from shock. You got it? See, the ship's problemometer is already pegged at maximum since, you know, some jackass got suckered into allowing, no, helping, an enemy AI to send a distress call to the elders. I said I'm sorry about that. You did? Oh. Well, that makes it all better. Oh, shut up. Since the needle on the problem meter is set on infinite, there can't be any more major problems. You might think that, Joe, but the universe loves to kick you when you're down. This time, the universe is gleeful to run you over with a bus, then back up over your flattened corpse and do it again. Just for fun. Ah, crap. What is it this time? Wait, how the hell did you just find out about another major problem? We are, I checked the status indicators on my Z-phone in case something had changed without my notice. In the middle of freaking nowhere. The status dashboard showed Valkyrie was 2.5 light years from the closest star, a single light year from a wandering rogue planet, and 4 light days from the wormhole we had come through an hour ago. The ship's jump drive capacitors were in a normal recharge cycle, and no alert had sounded to indicate any danger had been detected by the sensors. We are in the middle of nowhere. I just learned about the problem now because until now I hadn't been looking closely at the debris of that battleship. The dead one I detected. Yeah, I remember. I paused while buttoning my uniform top. Now I'm interested. To understand my incredible powers of deduction? To understand how a dead battleship could be a problem for us. Did you do something stupid like sell combat insurance on that ship?
Of course not.
Huh. Wow, we can do that? That is a great idea. I should know. That is a terrible idea.
Are you sure? We could be missing out on an incredible business opportunity here.
I'll pass, thank you. Focus, please. I pleaded with him, knowing I was at fault for getting him off the subject. The battleship he was talking about was the Maxalt ship that we discovered when we came through the last wormhole. That ship, and 3 of its escorts, had been blasted apart by a superior force. Skippy estimated the battle happened 3 days before we arrived. It was mildly interesting that a Maxalt ship had been engaged in combat on that side of the wormhole in what was technically Wargalan territory. I say it was only technically Squid territory, since those lowly clients lacked the power to enforce their territorial rights against the patrons at the top of their coalition, and because the Wargalan did not have even a space station within 30 light-years of that wormhole. A massive supernova in that area 200,000 years ago had blasted star systems in a 60-light-year radius with deadly radiation, and that section of the Centaurus arm was mostly red dwarf stars anyway. Skippy analyzed the debris and determined the battle was long over, with echoes of multiple Maxalt ships jumping away around the same time. The dead ships had not been part of the rebel force that came back to attack Earth, so we assumed the story was a hegemony battle group got jumped by rebels in their hot and nasty civil war. A civil war that we are responsible for, and I feel just awful about that. Anyway, a bunch of rotten kitties killed a bunch of other rotten kitties, and the only reason for me to care is that I wasn't there with a bowl of popcorn to watch. Why is it a problem for us that a hegemony ship got blasted? The rebels have gained momentum and are ambushing government forces. That's all good news, right? It would be if that was the real story here. It isn't. The truth is that ship is part of the 11th Assault Group from Castodon that defected to the rebels on the second day of the Civil War. Sorry it took so long to identify the ship. The kitties deliberately disguised the ID codes embedded in the hull. So that was a rebel ship, and it was destroyed by a superior hegemony force? Rebel ship, yes. A superior force, no. Not even close. Based on the jump signatures and the types of weapons involved, that heavy battle group was destroyed by a cruiser squadron. Holy, how did that happen? Well, I know Admiral Reichert selected his senior officers for loyalty rather than competence, but he actually pushed aside the most competent officers because they were a threat to him. But in this case, it doesn't look like poor tactics by the battlegroup were the reason for the lopsided loss. The spiders were involved.
Whoa.
Yeah, hence why I described this as a major problem. Let me understand this. The freaking spiders worked with one group of their enemy to destroy another group of kitties? Okay, this could still be good news. How? If the spiders are working to keep the civil war going, that's all good for us, duh. It would be, except you're wrong, duh. The spiders want to end the war, not keep it going. I'm not following you, Skippy. How the hell can you know that? I intercepted communications between the ships involved on both sides of the battle. Space dust out here is fluorescing from being struck by those photons which are still randomly bouncing around. The data is arriving in a chaotic fashion that is nearly random, but not entirely random. All I have to do is set all the pieces in the correct order to reassemble the original message, then decrypt it. Easy enough. The job is just so tedious. I appreciate the effort. Truthfully, since most of the crew aren't talking to me right now, I have extra time on my hands. Might as well do something productive.
If I wasn't so desperately bored, I wouldn't have bothered to solve what I expected would be a minor puzzle. What you did is still amazing, Skippy. To give you a peek behind the curtain, it was less difficult than it sounds. The Maxalts and Rindaloo use incompatible communications systems. Each side makes their systems deliberately incompatible to make it more difficult for the enemy to read their messages. The communication protocols, transmission methods, even the hardware is set up to make the messages tough to intercept. So when Kitty and Spider ships do want to exchange messages, they have to boost their transmission power, use a simple encryption scheme, and repeat each message segment several times. They even send a plain text header before each message stating how many segments should be expected. He sounded a bit disappointed in himself. I knew how much it hurt him to admit something he did was less awesome than it appeared. Let me ask you this. Could anyone else in this galaxy have intercepted those messages? Dude, please. As if. Maybe a full array of Rindaloo AIs could do it if they had specialized equipment out here, and they knew what they were looking for, and they had a couple of months to develop the proper algorithms. Uh-huh. Yet you're worried that I will think you are slightly less than maximally awesome? Joe, I'm worried that I will think I'm slightly less than maximally awesome. You think I am an arrogant asshole? That thought never crossed my mind. Very funny. Listen, Knucklehead. The truth is that most of the time, I'm guessing what to do. If I guess wrong, a lot of people will die. The only way I can cope with the enormous pressure is to constantly remind myself how extremely awesome I am. Have you heard the expression, fake it till you make it? Sure. My secret is I am always faking it. Wow, I have to be honest, I kinda wish you hadn't told me that. Thanks a lot, jackass. Sorry, that was a jackass thing to say. Skippy, everyone fakes it. Except psychopath narcissists. No, they're the worst. They act that way because they're so fragile. You're a psychologist now? I know basic stuff about people, Skippy. I appreciate it's hard for you to, you know, do everything you do. And as your friend, I'm honored that you told me how you feel. Ugh. Now I'm gonna throw up in my mouth. How about we fist bump and pretend this conversation never happened? What conversation? He bumped my fist. Now, can we get back to the messages you intercepted? The spiders are trying to stop the Kitty Civil War? Why the hell would they do that? They should be thrilled that their enemies have fallen apart. All the freaking spiders have to do is sit back with a bowl of popcorn and enjoy the show. We did all the work. Joe, you're basing your assessment on a false assumption. Like what? That the Maxalts are enemies of the Rindaloo. The Kitties have tried several times to wipe out the spiders, so yeah. The Maxalts consider the Rindaloo to be their mortal enemies, that is true, but the spiders view the leaders of the rival coalition as frenemies. Oh, that is not... Oh, you understand? OMG. That is a super cynical way to think, Skippy. Right, because being idealistic about the actions of biological beings has never disappointed me. He rolled his eyes. The spiders need the Kitties. As long as the Maxalts and their coalition of unwilling clients are a threat, the clients of the Rindaloo need the spiders to protect them. The situation in the galaxy remains violent, but predictable. The violence is under control, and the constant warfare drains the resources of clients on both sides. Murderous asshole species like the Theranin have their dangerous instincts directed in a way that is not harmful to either apex species. If the Maxalts become so weak that their clients break away, the galaxy will be thrown into utter chaos. That is exactly the situation that Emily Perkins worked to create. She thought weakening the patron-client relationships would make humanity safer. That is true to a limited extent, and in the long term. The very long term. She did not anticipate we would gain the ability to crash wormhole networks. If yous know what I mean, he added in a conspiratorial whisper. I know what yous mean, Skippy. That and capturing a freaking sentinel. Adding each of those abilities totally changed the equation. Now the apex species both have an incentive to control their clients, to protect humanity, so we don't retaliate against the Kitties and spiders. Except for, you know, when they ordered their clients to conduct annoying raids against Earth. Those attacks were more than annoying, I protested. It sounds callous, but in the big picture, the raids were merely pinpricks. The Maxalts know they can only push humans so far and no more. There is a limit to even their murderous insanity. Overall, the galaxy being organized into two warring coalitions is a good thing for you monkeys.
You mean it would be if we actually could crash wormhole networks and if we really had a fully capable Sentinel? Well, yes. The reality is we can't allow the Spiders to bail out the hegemony. We need that civil war to drag on for a long time and bleed the kiddies dry, especially now that we're trying to stop the Elders from destroying us all. Joe, I agree with everything you said. All I'm doing is explaining why the Rindaloo are assisting their supposed bitter enemies. Yeah, well, we need to break up that beautiful romance. Except shit, we need to deal with the freaking Elders. We can't get tied down with side quests. Side quests? He snorted. You know what I mean. Eh, I suspect that is a short-term problem anyway. The Spiders have a self-interest in helping their enemy avoid a total collapse, but they will also want the Kitty's internal war to continue. The hegemony capturing a Sam Francisco? He chuckled at the name he'd given to the fake Elder AI. Right. I stopped myself from rolling my eyes. That has changed the strategic situation. What I don't understand is, why aren't the Spiders panicking? They think their enemy has an Elder AI, and they just lost their own. They know how dangerous an Elder AI can be. They don't know. What? The Rindaloo do not know how dangerous an Elder AI can be. In their experience, such AIs do absolutely nothing. Okay, that's true, but by now, the Spiders will certainly have intercepted the info package that Scarandum sent to the ECO with all the sensor data he collected about Sam. That fake data clearly shows that while Sam's canister exhibits internal power flows characteristic of an active AI, it has not done anything. It supposedly helped Jaetes get off the surface of Frisco, and then blocked Scarandum's ship from setting a course back to Jarapha territory. Yes, but those are the only signs that Sam was active at all, and it didn't actually cooperate with Jaetes or the Jarapha. The Rindaloo have no reason to think that Sam will assist the Kitties any more than Opie ever helped them. As far as the Spiders know, Opie did exactly nothing for them. It didn't do anything for them. Exactly. The Spiders will wait to see whether Sam is any different from Opie. That's a hell of a risk. The Rindaloo rarely act in a hasty manner, you know that. And they are smart. The Spiders have been around for a long time, and they have seen some shit, including a whole lot of sketchy stuff that has happened recently. The incident with Sam involved humans and the ECO. Specifically, it involved the Mavericks and Scarandum. The bullshit detector of the Spiders must be going crazy. They have to at least consider that Sam is a fake. Well, shit. I don't know what to do about this. Joe, my advice is don't do anything. Not right now. Doing nothing about a problem went against my instincts. I'm getting breakfast. Let me think about it. The Maxalk's homeworld, Kazalakan, was supremely well protected, and security measures had been increased after Reichert's treachery was revealed. Initially, the rebellion within the fleet was viewed as a political embarrassment rather than a serious threat, and major fleet units were called in to provide a show of force to demonstrate to the public the power of their leaders. Then, as individual ships, squadrons, and the entire task forces defected to the rebels, the loyalty of the fleet itself became suspect, and warships were ordered out of the star system. Defenses now consisted of the powerful multi-layer SD network and energy shields that surrounded the planet. Activating the shield was an extreme measure, a move taken only after much heated debate within the government's senior levels. The shield enhanced physical security, yet there were many officials who considered the rebellion to be a political problem, one that should not have needed a military solution. The government had miscalculated badly, stupidly, when it ordered the arrest of almost all fleet commanders with ties to the disgraced former Admiral Reichert. That had been a panicked reaction by a weak regime, fearing for its own survival. The same government had promoted Reichert, encouraging him to consolidate power so he could better serve their purposes. The instant those politicians feared the monster they'd created was turning to bite them, they'd abandoned him and acted to crush any power base he had built. What the government should have done, the detractors argued, was act with calm strength rather than panicked fear. To act only against a few of the most senior officers associated with Reichert, those he selected for loyalty instead of competence. Those talentless idiots the entire fleet knew were worthless, and no one would miss. It was too late to fix those mistakes, and the government argued their hand had been forced anyway. The political security personnel on scene had correctly followed protocol when the treachery of Fleet Commander Reichert was discovered. Security officers had seized control of the ships at Earth and detained senior officers so that a full investigation could be conducted. Everyone involved knew that the investigation would be a political witch hunt, serving to protect the careers of the same politicians who had allowed Reichert to grow into a monster. They were eager to feed his ambition when it served their purposes. They were even more eager to exact revenge when they learned their pet had been scheming to bite them. Arresting the entire senior leadership of a fleet in an active combat zone was perhaps overkill, but political security officers were chosen for loyalty, not for their judgment. They were trained not to think, but to follow protocol, and they did. Being so far from Maxolk's territory, and with all ships held motionless by the horrific Sentinel, it had not been possible to seek guidance from someone more politically astute. Still, the mess could have been sorted out in a way that did not lead to open rebellion. The officers associated with Reichert would have faced prison, at least discharge from the service, and possibly execution, but the situation could have been resolved peacefully. Then a hack by Red Section had released many of the senior officers and locked the security personnel out of all systems. From that point, there was not much question about whether the senior leaders of that fleet should meekly accept their fates or fight. No Maxolk's warrior surrenders. They would fight. That was why the entire rebel fleet, or every ship that was combat ready, approached the homeworld of their people. Once a heavily populated world, stripped of resources and burdened with a large population that competed with heavy industry for power, land, and even the polluted air, most of the planet had long been restored to a pristine state. Modeled after what the world was believed to be like before their people discovered electricity and launched an industrial revolution, the population was legally limited to 400 million, clustered in cities, while the countryside was reserved for farmland and recreation such as hunting. The best land, of course, was set aside for pleasure palaces and hunting grounds for senior government officials. Those officials lived and worked in the capital city, served by millions of functionaries, and protected by multiple layers of defenses. The rebels were aware of those defenses, knew them very well. Some of the rebels had worked on designing, managing, and maintaining those systems. They knew the strengths and weaknesses of each layer. Perhaps weakness was not the correct word, for the planet's defenses were formidable. But even the most stout defenses could not be equally strong everywhere and in all aspects. The defense planners had focused on protecting the defense systems themselves, protecting the machines that protected their masters from harm. The assumption was that an enemy would seek to invade or blockade the planet, and the strategic defense system had to hold off the enemy until additional units of the glorious Maxolk's fleet could arrive. The rebels were not planning a blockade or an invasion. They lacked the resources for either of those actions, and a conventional military victory was not their goal. A victorious assault against the homeworld would actually work against their needs. The resulting enormous loss of civilian lives and damage to the hegemony fleet would make the population view the rebels the way they were portrayed by the government, as bloodthirsty fanatics. What the rebels needed was to make a statement, a strong statement. The right statement, to frame the conflict in terms the population could understand, could even sympathize with. It was a tricky operation with lines that should not be crossed, but could all too easily be crossed in the fog of war. The attack was carefully planned to minimize the potential for fatal mistakes, and a few commanders who were known for poor discipline were assigned to a support role where they couldn't do much damage to the cause. The attack began when a hegemony task force detected 8 rebel sensor frigates jumping in, followed by 3 heavy cruisers. The rebel ships jumped away in a sloppy, uncoordinated manner, but an alarm was sounded. Picket ships were dispersed to alert all fleet units in the area and to prepare the homeworld's defenses. Reactors held in reserve were rapidly brought online to power energy shields over major population centers. The SD network went to full alert. Any chance the rebels had for surprise was gone. It never occurred to the defenders that their response was part of the rebel plan. Nothing happened for a quarter of the planet's day. Defenses did not go to a lower alert status. The public remained in shelters. Energy shields were not switched off. The AIs responsible for the defense systems did not grow weary, did not relax, did not become bored or distracted. The rebels were weak and growing weaker. They had to launch a desperate attack, strike a blow, or both sides knew the rebellion would simply fade away. the AI that analyzed the situation, predicting the most likely form of rebel action, were correct that an attack was coming. They were completely wrong about the objective the rebels hoped to accomplish. They were also wrong about the attack plan. Rather than leading with their heaviest, most capable warships, the rebels deployed their least powerful assets, vessels that arguably were not even warships at all. Every star carrier available to the rebels jumped in near the planet in a tight formation just beyond the upper range of the SD platforms. The vulnerable, spindly carriers were heavily burdened, all of their hardpoints loaded with deadly payloads. Not warships, not missiles, rocks. They carried rocks. Heavy, dense rocks. Iron-rich asteroids, harvested from a remote star system. Rebel leadership had debated taking the time to manufacture dedicated penetrators made of specially hardened exotic ceramics. It was decided they had neither the time nor resources to construct enough penetrators to achieve the objective. Rocks could be selected, harvested, and shaped with the time and equipment available. Big rocks. Lots of them. Enough to overwhelm the defenses. Each of the deadly objects had been attached to star carriers that accelerated hard for 8 days until they reached the designated speed and direction. Seconds after the star carriers emerged from rips in space-time near Kozilikon, their jump fields nearly overlapping, power was cut to the hardpoints. The nanofiber cables disintegrated, and small explosive charges pushed the asteroids outward, clearing a path for the motherships that were decelerating at the limit of their engine power. Missiles streaked out and upward from the orbiting SD platforms, seeking the space trucks. One, two, then four of the star carriers were struck and torn apart before they could jump away. The rest disappeared in bursts of gamma radiation. That left the rocks falling inward, the gravity well of the planet pulling them down faster and faster, adding to their already tremendous speed. Rocks. The objects were just rocks. They had no energy shields, no stealth. All they had was kinetic energy. And numbers. And the fact that every rock was aimed at a single target on the surface of the planet. The command and control bunker where the senior leaders of the government were huddled to ride out the attack. The AIs that managed the defenses analyzed the situation again and were puzzled. The assault would accomplish little, even given the unexpected nature of the rebel action. Some rocks would get through the orbiting defenses, some of them would even punch through the powerful ground-based defenses. It was a matter of simple math. The capabilities of the defenses compared to the kinetic energy of the incoming objects. Some of the asteroids would get through. Most of those would strike not the ground, but the energy shield that protected the underground bunker where the senior leadership had been evacuated to when the alert sounded. The energy shield would fail, overwhelmed. A crater would form where a mountain existed before the attack. The secure base, deep below the surface, would suffer damage, though the AIs calculated the senior leaders would survive in their bunker. Satisfied that they had properly prepared a defense plan, the best available under the circumstances, the strategic defense AIs instructed the orbital platforms to begin firing in a specific sequence that maximized the damage to the incoming space rocks. As an FYI, one of the AIs passed the results of the analysis to the senior officials huddled fearfully in their bunker. The meat sack masters of the AIs could read the analysis if they were curious or wanted to amuse themselves to pass the time, or they could ignore the report. What the Maxalts could not do was anything that was actually useful. For that, they had constructed the AIs. Again, the defense AIs were wrong. The government officials in the bunker had no ability to coordinate defenses or to aim and fire even a single weapon with enough speed and accuracy to make a difference in the brief but energetic battle. But they did have one skill the AIs were not programmed for. The meat sacks in the bunker, survivors of decades of vicious battles that occurred around tables and in hallways rather than in the cold environment of space, those meat sacks knew politics. Too late, they understood the rebel plan. When the last falling rock was vaporized by blasts from particle cannons based on the surface, the brief battle was over. One hemisphere of the world was lit up by bright streaks of rocks still falling, pieces that had been thrown sideways when an asteroid was ripped apart by directed energy bolts, particle beams, or ship-killer missiles. Within the first few seconds of the engagement of technology versus rocks, The SD controller AIs realized that railgun darts only split the dangerous rocks into more numerous dangerous rocks, so the railgun platforms were removed from the fight. Shipkiller missiles, with their massive atomic compression warheads, could flash even an iron-rich asteroid into relatively harmless dust and were the first choice for the SD network. At first. On second thought, the AIs decided they should hold the shipkillers in reserve to kill the rebel ships that surely would jump in at any moment in a follow-up attack. That left directed energy weapons such as masers and lasers and particle cannons. Those weapons had the advantage of a practically unlimited supply of ordnance, and hasty experiments determined that multiple beams focused against a single rock could heat it to the point where the asteroid exploded from its core, leaving falling chunks that posed no military threat. There still were not enough beam weapon platforms available in the small area where all the space rocks were falling. The AIs prioritized the available assets as best they could and devoted most of their attention to writing a lengthy report to justify their decisions so they would not be deactivated when the battle was over. With a significant hole in the SD network and many previously stealth orbital platforms having exposed their positions, the defense AIs waited for rebel ships to jump in and launch a second wave of attacks. A conventional attack. The AIs concluded the rebels had devoted all their star carriers to the unexpected first wave. The actual second wave arrived not as a conventional assault by heavy combatants, but as thinly armored frigates appearing in the sky, sending a message via powerful transmitters aimed at the population centers. Other frigates had been positioned throughout Maxulk's territory to spread the word to as many citizens as possible. The message was the actual weapon deployed by the rebels, not rocks or missiles. The message was not the usual crazed revolutionary diatribe where a listener could hear the spit hitting the microphone as the angry speaker shouted hysterical grievances. No, this message was dangerous because it made its statement in a calm, matter-of-fact manner. The facts it claimed were the rebels were at war only with the cowardly, corrupt leadership of the hegemony, and that is why they struck only the bunker where those leaders were hiding. Those same cowardly leaders had approved a doomsday plan to activate sentinels across the galaxy by detonating elder weapons. The hegemony, its people, and civilization would have been sacrificed, with only the senior leaders and their families surviving in a faint hope of preserving Maxulk's culture in the far future. The doomsday plan had been approved only because those same senior leaders had lost faith in the ultimate destiny of the Maxulk's people. Those leaders no longer believed their culture was superior, no longer believed the Maxulk's had a special right to rule the galaxy. Those leaders had therefore lost any right to the loyalty of the hegemony. The message ended with a plea to all personnel in the fleet, whose faith in their destiny was still strong, to join the rebellion, to restore the honor of the Maxulk's people, to return to the path that would result in them taking their rightful place as masters of the galaxy. The hegemony senior leadership, when communication to their buried bunker was restored, immediately launched a public relations campaign to control the damage. It was the rebels who had lost faith, the government claimed. Their former leader, the disgraced former Admiral Reichert, had been the architect of the Doomsday Plan. When the Doomsday Fleet was lost due to his negligence, he secretly pursued a reckless, insane project with Red Section to awaken Sentinels anyway. The rebel leaders were those lackeys chosen by Reichert for their weakness and incompetence, and the people of the hegemony should and would not be fooled by the lies of those who were only trying to escape justice for their own criminal acts against the very public they claimed to be fighting for. The war of words, blah, 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 raged back and forth with psychologists leading the battle. The result was some additional hegemony fleet units defecting to the rebels, with the remainder of the military demanding that the only solution to the rebellion was to hunt down and crush the criminals, and the public increasingly fearful of both sides. Both sides argued about who was lying. Neither side addressed the biggest lie. The supposed destiny of the Maxulk's people was 100% pure bullshit.